is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name is Matt Brand. Good to be with you for another week of the Country Hour. As we go to air this afternoon, ex-tropical cyclone Esther is getting ready to cross the NT-WA border and come back into the territory, where it's expected to deliver some pretty handy rain to the Tanami and parts of Central Australia. We'll be speaking to the Weather Bureau at 1:05 to get the latest. And also today, we'll find out how Darwin River Dam is faring. A big week of rain in the top end last week. How much went into the dam? We'll find out soon. We'll also today check out some new cassava trials that are underway near Katherine. And we missed out on speaking to her on Friday, but I promise you, Country Hour fans, I promise you that Pauline from Top Springs will be on the radio today. After 12 years managing that remote roadhouse, Pauline has retired, and she says the phone's been ringing off the hook in the last couple of days from people wishing her all the best.
So many phone calls and gifts and that from just the loveliest people out, which I didn't expect in any shape or form, love.
A legend of the top end, and she will be on your radio before 1:30. We're going to start today's program taking a look at the unusual case of Australia's wool industry being hacked. Wool sales across Australia were cancelled last week after the IT system underpinning auctions and exports was hit by a cyber attack. Now, it's expected sales will resume this week, but there's still a lot of unknowns and a lot of concern about this. To tell us more is Nikolai Balehearts. He's the presenter of the Victorian Country Hour. Nikolai, what happened?
So what happened was on Tuesday morning last week, the Australian Wool Exchange became aware that the IT system that basically underpins everything at AWEX had been faced a cyber attack, which what's known as ransomware. So basically it kind of locks the computer system up and says, if you give us a lot of money, we'll unlock the computer system and you can use it again. And so that was kind of the case through most of last week, and they were trying to get it this IT software up and running again, but they couldn't. So all sales were cancelled.
So do we know who was it and who was wanted the money?
No, look, it's not really clear who it was. It's kind of, if you remove yourself from the fact that it's been a pretty distressing time for wool growers, it's an interesting question about who's doing it and why. Like, are they, whoever it is, you know, we hear a lot of mentions of Russia and China and those kinds of places. Are they aware that this was the IT system that underpins the wool market? Because if they were, that's arguably a relatively clever thing to pick as opposed to just my computer at home or your computer at home. Because it's, you know, we're talking $50, $60 million worth of sales going through the wool markets every week. So the desire to get it up and running again would be very high by the operators. So I guess the hope from the hacker's point of view was maybe they'll get tempted and pay up the ransom.
So in terms of the damage that this cyber attack has caused, is that the dollar figure? It's cost industry $50 to $60 million?
Well, I guess it's delayed $50 or $60 million is maybe the way to put it. Because what will happen this week, hopefully, is that the wool sales will get going again. Not all of the wool that was on offer last week will be sold this week because, you know, like everybody said, you kind of can't cram 2 weeks' worth of sales into a week. They actually have a cap on how much can run through the system any given week. So I think you might not say it's done $50 million worth of damage, but it will have made life uncomfortable for people that were counting on selling wool last week who were told, I'm sorry, you can't.
So is it back up and running? Is the system fixed?
We're told it is almost back up and running. There are a few, so they had backups and they were able to build the system back up from those backups. The way that it seems to have been put is that they're kind of dotting the I's and crossing the T's of the IT system to get it going. There are a few last little niggles of trying to get some of the brokers back online and that kind of thing. But certainly the message that we've got is that they are very hopeful that the system will be up and running and say that the majority of it is basically ready to go.
And just before I let you go, Nikolai, you'll appreciate that in the Northern Territory we don't do too many wool stories. Tell us, is it a good time to be in the business of wool?
Yeah, look, it's the sheen's come off a little bit. Things were a little bit better probably 6 or 8 months ago when we saw really high record prices. The old adage that I was told a while ago, so this might have shifted a little bit, but what I've always been told is if wool's above 1,000 cents for the Eastern Indicator, so like the Eastern Young Cattle Indicator, there's kind of these, you know, market measures. If it's above 1,000 cents, then people generally are kind of just making money. For a while, it was right around or above 2,000 cents, and it's kind of backed off now by about 500 cents. So, look, overall, things are still looking good. The other kind of interesting thing with all of this is wool seems to be one of the relatively few commodities that so far is unscathed by coronavirus. You know, we haven't seen a big drop-off in demand from China, where they have dropped off demand in other ag commodities. So at the moment, at least, I think the wool guys are relatively happy that the bales are still making their way on boats over.
Thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Big thanks to Nikolai Balehart. He's the presenter of the Victorian Country Hour. And as he mentioned, there's still a lot of unknowns around this cyber attack. A lot of unknowns on exactly who hacked the system, what they were after, how much money they were after as part of the ransom. Reports range from $8 million up to $30 million was the ransom being demanded. The director of the New South Wales Cyber Security Network, Todd Williams, he says it'll be really hard for the authorities to work out who was behind this attack.
With cybersecurity these days in a connected world, it's extremely difficult to find out who is actually behind those things. I mean, there's areas of offensive cyber attack excellence. It's easy to point a finger at other countries around the world that have got history with this, but it's very difficult to find out who it would be.
So we're hearing rumours that it's the Russians. You know, it was $8 million, but there's no way of corroborating that. Is that what you're saying?
There's no real way. But, you know, the case study suggests that Russia is good at this. China could be good at this as well. There could be people who are thinking that they're Russians and Chinese, but they could be locals. It's just really difficult to put a finger on exactly who's behind it.
But there is one international precinct you mentioned to me earlier in Canada, yeah?
Yeah, look, there's case studies, well, terrible case studies about cybersecurity actually affecting people physically. And, you know, there's been case studies such as Russian malicious attacks against Canadian water supplies and because the pumps within the water system are networked, shutting the pumps down and no water coming out of the taps. So, of course, that's a very effective way to use cybersecurity and to extract large amounts of money to get the pumps turned back on.
Did the government in that case pay up?
My belief is that they did, yeah.
And technically, is there anything that organisations can do to avoid this kind of, to protect themselves from this sort of attack?
Yeah, look, still, cyber primarily is a people problem. Over 70% of issues that happen with cybersecurity come from people doing something a little bit silly. Ransomware attacks, clicking on emails that don't look right is still the number one way that malicious people with cyber tie up people's files and extract money.
So but someone may have inadvertently allowed that cyber attack into the network?
Well, of course. That's the main way that these things happen. And it really is getting the basics right with basic level education and getting some basic systems in place to prevent this happening again.
That's Todd Williams. He's the director of the New South Wales Cyber Security Network, speaking to David Claughton. An intriguing story. You can read more about it online right now if you go searching for ABC Rural. It's 20 to 1 here on the Country Hour. Now, Darwin River Dam, it is the major source of water for the Darwin region. How is it looking after a big week of rain in the top end? We'll find out straight after this tune by Sean Colvin.
Hello, my name is Lynette Simon. I come from West Island, where we've been eradicating feral cats, and you're listening to Country Hour.
Last week was a wet one for the top end, with ex-tropical cyclone Esther delivering more than 200 millimetres of rain for a number of spots on the map. But how much fell in the catchment area for Darwin River Dam? Remember, this dam supplies Darwin with about 85% of its water. And in January, it was sitting at its lowest level on record. So we want water in the dam. Trevor Durlin, he's the Senior Water Planning Engineer at Power and Water Corporation. Trevor, how's Darwin River Dam looking?
It's great to see some rain in our region. Darwin River Dam is now at 59.5%. Let's call that 60% storage,
yep.
Up from a low point of 52% earlier in the year. We've seen a 55-centimetre rise in water levels in the dam in the last week or so with that bit of rain that we've had. But that's about four times as much rain as has actually fallen on the dam itself. So that tells us that our catchment is well saturated now, and the rain that falls in the catchment is now running off into the dam. So that's great news.
Have you still got creeks flowing? For example, if it doesn't rain at all for the rest of this week, do you expect that number to rise?
Yeah, that's right. So as the runoff makes its way into the dam, we'll continue to see some benefit in the reservoir itself. How long that lasts for really depends on how much rain has fallen in the catchment. But, you know, now that the catchment's saturated, that's good news, and it means that if we have some good falls now across the rest of the wet season, we should see water levels rise in the dam significantly.
So the dam sitting at 60% as we go to air this afternoon. This time last year, it was sitting at 78%. How are you feeling at the moment, Trevor?
Well, Matt, we currently have around 186 billion litres, so those are gigalitres, 186 gigalitres of water stored in the dam. Annual demand for water in Darwin is around 42 billion litres, so there's still plenty of water left in the dam at the moment. But the poor wet season last year means that we're starting from the lowest dam level since 2006, so getting a full recharge is not necessarily guaranteed. And as you know, you never know what the rest of the wet is going to bring. So our advice to the community is to always be careful with your water use, and when the rain arrives, turn off your irrigation and let Mother Nature take care of your garden.
Does Power and Water Corporation have a magic number when it comes to the dam level, like a percentage that once you reach that, you feel comfortable and know that the year ahead will be fine?
Darwin's water supply system is designed to be very robust and survive through a series of poor wet seasons. We're always more comfortable when dam levels are higher, but we've got a very robust system that can survive. And we've had a good run over the last decade or 15 years where most years the dam has filled and spilled. But prior to that, we survived through a series of years in the 80s and 90s where the dam didn't fill and spill for more than a decade. So our system is designed to cope with that climate variability that we're subject to up here in the top end.
So just finally, I know last year because of water issues, Power and Water Corporation made the decision to stop taking underground water out there at Girraween and rely more so on the dam. In 2020, have you got a sense yet on what the mix might look like?
The standard mix is around 85% surface water and 15% groundwater. That's the standard operational regime that we work towards, and we'll be following that standard operation this year.
Thanks for your time today, Trevor.
No worries, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Trevor Durlin, he's the Senior Water Planning Engineer at Power and Water Corporation. So there you go. Darwin River Dam is sitting at about 60% as we go to air this afternoon. If you jump onto Power and Water Corporation's website, it says the dam is sitting at 55%, but I'm sure that data will be updated very soon. So that's what's happening at Darwin River Dam. There's a bit of water going into it, which is great news. How are the aquifers looking, though? Here on the Country Hour, every month we catch up with Des Yin Fu, who is the NT's Water Assessment Director. Des, new data's just come in regarding groundwater levels in Darwin's rural area. How are they looking? What's your summary?
The groundwater levels that we've measured across the rural area at the end of February are approximately about the levels that they were last year, this time last year. So it would have been nice to have had been topped up by now, that the rainfall totals have really fallen short of what we normally expect from an average sort of year. So we haven't reached those topped up levels that we were hoping to.
Some places have fared pretty well, though, yes. Like Girraween's doing better than it was this time last year. Berry Springs is now in better shape than it was at the end of last year's wet season. There's a bit of positivity there, isn't there?
Yeah. The rainfall totals in those more populous rural areas are actually not too bad, although we're still, you know, 700, 800 millimetres short of what we'd see as an average rainfall for a wet season. You know, on the fringe areas such as Middle Point, we're well down. It appears that, rainfalls just haven't landed it in the Middle Point area. So they're around about 800 millimetres, so it's a little bit short of what we'd hope.
And the groundwater levels at Howard Springs have actually dropped in the last month. Does that surprise you?
Well, not really, but I wouldn't say they've dropped by any great amount.
Yeah, it's only a little bit, but it's still a drop during the wet season.
Yeah, it's just a sort of bit of a fluctuation. But let's see what happens at the end of this month, and hopefully we get a good March rainfall, and we'll be able to at least add to what we've already got in the groundwater store.
The data that's available right now, does it take into account the big rainfall event of last week?
Groundwater levels do take a little while to respond. We took the water levels about middle of last week, so probably not seeing the full effect of the rainfall. But
right, yeah. So ESTA might not be appearing in the data that we see right now.
No, probably not.
Okay.
But I think the thing that we see is that we're still not getting a normal fill and spill sort of levels that we hope to get to by about now. And, you know, the rest of the wet season, we would normally hope just to maintain those high levels as a normal thing. But we're still down on groundwater levels, which means that stepping into the dry season, we're going to be pretty careful, like we were last year, and manage our water supplies.
Still 2 months left in the wet season. How are you feeling, Des?
I'm always optimistic, Matt. You know, but hopefully we won't have the same pressures as we had last year. At least people, hopefully took on board the message about how we, you know, need to be frugal with our groundwater use and just share the resources amongst the people in that same resource. So long as people remember that message and have got into some sort of habit about how to manage their bore supplies, I think we'll survive another probably tough year.
Thanks for your time, Des.
Okay, mate. Thanks.
Des Yin-Fu, he's the Territory's Water Assessment Director. He joins us every month to give us an idea of how those groundwater levels are faring in Darwin's rural area. Recharge is happening, but maybe not as quick as some people are hoping. It is 8 to 1 here on the Country Hour. The Territory's Department of Primary Industry is having a bit of a tinker with cassava and cattle near Katherine. Tell you more about it next.
The Women's T20 World Cup.
Hammered down the ground. She clears the side screen. Massive blow.
Driving out. What a catch, Mooney.
What a catch.
All the world's greatest players here.
Carey comes in, dives and takes a spectacular catch. An attempted cuts and brilliantly taken. Blown to the pool shot. Six.
Ball by ball coverage of the 2020 Women's T20 World Cup.
What a great catch.
Every match live on the ABC Listen app.
The Territory's Department of Primary Industry has started a trial to investigate the best ways of using cassava as a livestock feed. The tropical plant is commonly used in feedlots over in Indonesia, but there are some issues around its toxicity and how it can actually reduce weight gains in cattle if you get it all wrong. Carmen Brown caught up with Kieran McCosker at the Katherine Research Station to learn more about the study and its implications for local cattle producers.
Last time we spoke about cassava was we were talking about the growing of it and trying to process it. And recently we've done a small study in the pens. It's a precursor for a much larger study looking at, can we increase the intakes in cattle? Like what sort of rations can we make up to make sure that we get good intakes from cattle? And when you do that, of course, you increase the performance of the cattle that you're feeding it to.
And cassava is a little bit problematic, isn't it, in terms of just how much you can feed to stock. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so cassava is, there's two parts of cassava plant that we're interested. At the moment, we're only feeding the tuber or the root part of the plant. It's a high energy content. It's sort of comparable to a grain, but it's a high starch content. And then you've got the top of leaves, which are high in protein, and they can be around 20% protein. So the general scope of the project is, can we make a ration using those two parts of the plant? But at the moment, we were focusing just on the tuber side of it. And there's some anecdotal evidence from other parts of the world that feed cassava routinely, and it's the basis of a lot of diets. For instance, you know, a lot of the feedlot industry in Indonesia is based on cassava products and byproducts. So what we have found, or what others have found, is that when you include over 56% more than that in their diet, there's a negative association there, and animals start having lower intakes, and that, as a consequence of that, they have lower performance.
And just how much lower is that performance? Like, what do you see in terms of a response, I guess?
Well,
is it significant?
It is a big impact. So for those people who don't know, that there are cyanic compounds in cassava, we don't actually know what the cause of that negative association is, but when something becomes unpalatable and cattle don't want to eat it, you know, there's obviously some threshold there, and then you get performance back. Now, there's actually other work done in New Zealand with fodder beet, which is another tuber base or root plant that has high starch, high energy, and they've shown that if you increase the hay content or the roughage part of it, they also, the total amount of food of the high energy sort of food, they're able to lift that. So that was one of our treatments in this current study.
So what have you found in the early stages of the study? What sort of results are you seeing at this point?
Well, we had three different diets. We had a base cassava tuber ration of, it was 97% tuber, 2% urea and 1% mineral, trace minerals. And then we added different things to that. So we had soya bean meal. We put a little bit of molasses with it. And then we had, with the molasses and the soya bean meal, we added a higher amount of hay to go along with that. And the top group, which was the higher hay and the soya bean meal and the molasses with the base concentrate, we had an average of about 1.4 kilos a day, which we were happy with. Yeah.
And what's the next step now? What are you looking at next?
So we want to really tease out this association, or this, you know, when we push higher amounts of cassava in the diet, what's their performance like, and can we feed different products to reduce that effect?
Longer term, what do you think the implications of this study might be for the industry? Is there really, here in particularly the territory, is there much of an appetite for feeding this cassava to livestock?
There's interest around the place. I'd say it's a potential at the market. There's different things happening. I'm aware that there's a local grower that has sold some of their product to the Feed and Cube, I think. And so I suppose everyone's being a little bit exploratory at the moment. It's a tropical plant that grows really well. I would say there are mechanisms out there to harvest it efficiently, but if you don't have the appropriate equipment and things like that, well, it comes back to economics. You know, it might grow well, but how does it work in your system, and can you process it efficiently in a way that you can safely feed it to cattle or whatever you're using it for?
That's Kieran McCosker from the Katherine Research Station speaking to Carmen Brown about this cassava cattle feed trial that's underway there on the farm.
Hi, my name is Ian Boot. I'm the Managing Director of Austfish. Myself and my brother both went to sea when we were 16 as crewmen. I became a skipper at 19 years of age, and we become a multi-fleet about the age of about 25. I still enjoy the industry. It's full of characters, people from all walks of life. Good companions, good friends over the years. The industry is full of good people, without a doubt. And I enjoy it. It's very challenging. Yeah, I expect I'm going to be around for a few years yet. and you're listening to The Country Hour.
You sure are. If you'd like to get in touch with the program, our text number is 0487 99 1057. I've got a message here that says, Matt, there is a block in Berry Springs that has a large expanse of green lawn and their sprinklers are still going even though it's pouring rain. The aquifer level, as we've been hearing, is low. Can someone please tell them to stop wasting our precious resource? Says someone on the text. So there you go. Whoever's out in Berry Springs with the sprinklers on, turn them off. Hey, just quickly before we get to the 1 o'clock news, the company Arafura Resources, so it's the one that wants to start up a big rare earths mine to the north of Alice Springs. It says it's reached an in-principle agreement with the native title holders of that region, the Indigenous Land Use Agreement, the ILUA, as they're often referred to as. This will now go before a full council meeting of the CLC on April 6th for endorsement. But yes, an in-principle agreement has been reached. They had a big meeting at Aileron. And the stock market likes what it hears, up 6.6% as we go to air this afternoon. It's news time. I'll catch you back here in 5 minutes.
Hey, g'day. It's James Asantis from the Tiwi Islands. Been involved with the Tiwi Rangers for the last 4 years. Yeah, what I love about being a ranger is like just getting out and looking at my country and, yeah, just seeing all the different things you know, you see them one day and then the day you don't see them and then all of a sudden it pops up again and, yeah, it's just great seeing these different changes all the time. And you're listening to The Country Hour. Thank you.
Matt Brown with you this afternoon. If you tuned in on Friday, oh, it was borderline debacle. Spent most of the program promising you that we'd be speaking to Pauline out at Top Springs. Pauline's been in charge of that remote roadhouse for 12 years. She's an absolute legend, and Friday was her last day. So I spent all of Friday saying, gee, stick with us, we're going to have a chat to Pauline. And then when the time came to call her up, the phone was engaged, apparently because of you. She told me later that all of a sudden people just started ringing up the pub to wish her all the best. That was you who did that, and we missed out on speaking to her on Friday. But I eventually got hold of her, and she'll be sharing some memories, some stories with you about her 12 years at Top Springs before 1:30 today. Looking forward to it. And we'll also hear from the president of the National Farmers Federation. The NFF has set this very lofty target of Australian ag being valued at $100 billion by the year 2030. So how's that target looking at the moment? Can Australian ag make it in under 10 years? Fiona Simpson. We'll be talking about that in a moment. Let's go to the Weather Bureau. Rebecca Patrick is there this afternoon. Beck, ex-tropical cyclone Esther, where is it right now?
Yeah, that's the story of the week. Esther currently is over the southeast parts of the Kimberley District in northern Western Australia, and she is making her way back towards the Territory, so expecting to cross the NT border tonight and moving into the northern parts of the Tanami District. We are starting to see a bit of rainfall coming across already from that system, with some reasonable totals. Rabbit Flat has received over 50 millimetres to 9 a.m. and has received another 20 millimetres already today. So, yeah, some good rainfall through that area. And we do have a severe weather warning for damaging winds developing as Esther gets closer, as well as heavy rainfall and a flood watch current as well.
Can you give us a sense of where this system, Esther, is likely to track over the next few days?
Yeah, so as I said, moving into the far north of the Tanami District tonight, then that's expected to track across the Tanami District tomorrow, heading towards the southern parts of the Barkly District, during Wednesday. So on Wednesday, it does start to move a little bit faster. So moving across from sort of around the southwest of the Barkly and then out into Queensland by Wednesday night.
And so how many millimetres of rain could people expect, say, if you're in places like, you know, Alicurong, Barrow Creek and the such?
Yeah, well, over Western Australia, they've seen 24-hour totals near the centre of the low of 150 to 200 millimetres, so really quite high amounts up there. Seeing that across the northern Tanami is not out of the question.
Wow.
But yeah, as it moves further east, expect it to weaken a little bit, but still getting some reasonable rainfall amounts. So, for example, around this southern Barkly, probably looking at 40 to 100 millimetres tomorrow, could get some isolated falls up to 180 millimetres in places. So,
wow.
Yeah, some quite significant rainfall through that area over the next couple of days.
It's quite the system. It really is. I got a message from a friend in Kununurra this morning. His farm's had 400 millimetres over the last 4 days. It's huge.
Wow, that's extraordinary, isn't it? Yeah, obviously it's good to get some rain, but can also cause some problems if you're trying to move about and get things done as well.
Will the Todd River flow?
It's a little bit of a tricky one. We're seeing a bit of conflicting guidance in terms of how far south the low will track, whether it affects more of the Simpson District. At this stage, it's certainly going to affect northern parts of that Simpson District. Probably get some good rainfall around Alice Springs, particularly tomorrow and into Wednesday. I think should see some good rainfall in the catchment.
There's actually a bit of action just on the Alice Springs radar this afternoon. Looks the goods.
Yeah, just some very light rain at the moment we're seeing on the radar, so not too intense, and haven't seen too much in the way of rainfall in gauges. I think it's only 0.2 in the rain gauge at the moment, so quite light rain, but yeah, that should be getting heavier tomorrow.
Mm, and I'm just looking at the Darwin radar now. That's quite a surge coming in from the west.
Yeah, it's a bit of a feeder band that's sort of linked to Esther. So we've got that northerly flow coming into the northeast of Esther that's bringing a good line of showers and storms across pretty much the whole of the western top end today. So, yeah, definitely expecting those showers and storms coming into Darwin shortly.
Anything else we need to know before I let you go, Beck?
I think that's the main things. Just keep an eye on those warnings. The flood watch will, and the severe weather warning will obviously, track across the NT as the system moves across. So, just keep an eye out for any changes to those warnings.
Beauty. Thank you for your time this afternoon.
No worries. Thanks, Matt.
That's Rebecca Patrick there at the Weather Bureau. And yes, just repeating, there is a severe weather warning in place this afternoon for damaging winds and heavy rainfall for people in parts of the Gregory and Tanami districts. On the text 0487 99 1057, Mark says, Matt, bit of a breeze here in Howard Springs. And a look on the radar shows rain. That ex-cyclone Esther is the gift that just keeps on giving, says Mark.
G'day, my name's Han. I'm a tropical fruit farmer out of Darwin. I am always too busy to listen to the Country Hour at lunchtime, so instead I will always listen to it after hours on the podcast.
Twelve past one on a Monday afternoon. Hope you're well. It is now less than 10 years before the National Farmers Federation's deadline to have Australian ag valued at $100 billion by 2030. It's a big target, and they've now got less than 10 years to achieve it. And as Australia continues to have a revolving door of agriculture ministers and difficulties in some markets, is the farm lobby group likely to achieve this goal? Is it likely to get anywhere near $100 billion? Warwick Long sat down with NFF President Fiona Simpson.
One of the reasons we were pleased to see David Littleproud back in the job was because he has been here before. And so, you know, Bridget McKenzie certainly did a good job in progressing things like the R&D work, for example, you know, and looking at the review of that. Now, some of these pieces of work just need to continue. So we hope that David Littleproud can quickly get his legs under the table and, to be quite honest, can just keep on going. We've got a lot. We've now got a nice, clear industry plan in terms of 2030. The government's reporting about, you know, their view on that and how they can contribute. Industry is standing behind it and is strongly, you know, contributing. We've already had one report back on it already, and we hope that David Littleproud can just keep on going.
9 years and 10 months away from that deadline. A lot of people say you can't get there. You've said in the past you've got to have aspirations, but can you have aspirations if you're not going to achieve them?
Oh, you have to have stretch targets. I mean, we absolutely have to have a plan for our industry and a focus. And that's what this vision always was. It's about bringing a vision to life. It's about putting clear targets and metrics around it and people understanding where their particular industry and focus needs to be.
What happens if you don't get there, though?
Well, if we don't get there, we have to just have given it a bloody good shot. And so that's what we're going for. And we won't beat ourselves up, but we have to really try hard. And by having it broken up into nice, achievable bites and nice achievable outcomes, then I hope, it's a bit like eating an elephant, isn't it? One bite at a time. We can just keep on doing it, and it's really important that we do.
How can the Agriculture Minister, the government's taken on your goal as well, how can they help agriculture get there?
Well, sensible policy, strategic policy. We need to grow our industry and grow rural and regional areas. What's an example of that? Well, we need to look at infrastructure, for example. I mean, it's incredibly difficult to get, you know, roads. It's some of just the physical infrastructure, whether we're talking about roads, rail, port. Some of it in rural and regional Australia is just quite frankly not fit for purpose. You know, there's an enormous backlog in rural and regional infrastructure. We need to attack some of those issues. We need to keep doing what we're doing in the trade space, not only opening up new markets, but also attacking some of those barriers that stop people delivering to those targets. We need to look at people, and well, that's more an industry issue, actually. How do we keep continuing to have the best and brightest? Let's look at biodiversity. NFF now is looking at, we have ecosystem services as one of our targets. Can we do something different in the policy space about managing natural assets that involves farmers? All of those needs good strategic government policy, and that's what we're talking to government about.
You can't count government paying farmers for looking after the environment as part of the $100 billion goal, can you?
No, it's not about government paying farmers. It's about the market paying farmers. We need financial instruments. That's what ecosystem services is. We know that overseas these instruments are created and that in actual fact it can return a diverse income stream to farmers. Farmers can keep doing what they're doing now in terms of strategically and being sustainable, strategically managing their farms to be sustainable. But they may well be paid for some of those outcomes if the community feels that they're important. So we don't take money from government in Australia, us farmers much. We're the least subsidised in the world, and we want to stay strong and viable in that way.
What's the reaction? This goal, the $100 billion goal, has been out there for some time. What reaction do you get from the farmers that you go and speak to? Are they behind you on this, or are they, as so often is in farming communities, quite sceptical of your ability to get there?
Sometimes they're a little bit divided, and obviously the drought has been really difficult for many people, but it's also really good to have this vision, and people are in the here and now so often. So I actually think by actually having some visibility about the future and knowing that their peak body is planning for the future, then it actually helps farmers sometimes just lift themselves out of the here and now, out of the, you know, all the things that they're dealing with, the myriad of things that they're dealing with, to think, no, we've got this. There's a strong future for our industry.
While you've got a new minister, do you need another ag white paper?
We don't need another ag white paper. We've got the $100 billion vision. That's all we need, and that's all the minister needs. He can pick it up and run with it. He did before. I know he's a huge supporter. All levels of government are supporting our $100 billion vision, and we're really excited about that. Next year when we report again, I hope that we're going to be able to report substantial progress on some of those goals.
That's the president of the National Farmers Federation, Fiona Simpson, speaking there to Warwick Long. Can Aussie Ag make that target of $100 billion in value by the year 2030? It is 17 past one here on the Country Hour. I wonder if we've got anyone listening this afternoon out at Lake Bennett, Darwin River Dam, or around the Manton Reserve, because looking at the Darwin radar, it suggests that it is absolutely flogging down rain there as we go to air this afternoon. How's it looking in your backyard? Make sure you send us a text. We always love getting the weather goss from you. 0487 99 1057. Our text number here at the Country Hour. There's a lot of colour in the Darwin radar this afternoon. It's looking the goods. We heard earlier that Darwin River Dam is sitting at 60% capacity. That radar suggests it might top up even a bit further this afternoon if that keeps up. I love it. I love the look of it. Now, have you ever been to Top Springs, which is on the junction of the Buntine and Buchanan Highways? If you've ever been there in the last 10, 12 years, there's a fair chance you've met her, Pauline. A legend of the North, a legend of the VRD, and she'll be on your radio after this tune by Sarah Storer. She has been the friendly face and voice of the Top Springs Hotel for 12 years. But on Friday, Pauline Hasseldine, she retired. She had her last day on Friday. She's an absolute legend. She's the unofficial mayor of Top Springs. Everyone in the VRD knows her. We were hoping to have her on the show on Friday, but we just could not get hold of her. I eventually tracked her down and she told me that, her final day was very eventful.
Well, this morning it was just been training new people. The new managers are Greg and Julie, lovely, lovely couple from WA. This is the second day of crash courses training up, but they're very competent people, lovely people, so they will do a good job. They care about the customers. It's not just about money figures coming through the door. There's empathy and understanding, and that's what you've got to have out here. You've got to take on people's needs and cares and do whatever, love. If it's an accident, you're first at scene of an accident or a road, or helping people out. The phone hasn't stopped ringing because the roads were flooded. So I went down to the Armstrong River. It was 1.6 over metres over the bridge yesterday, so people, the road was basically cut. No one could get to any communities. So I went down there and I got a flat tyre.
On your last day, a flat tyre.
That's right, and that's the first flat tyre I've had. So Greg, I called him on the two-way and he come down and repaired it, changed the wheel. So I was started cleaning off logs and stuff off the side of the bridge, so when the river comes up again, it might be able to flow through the water. So I've been clearing bridges this morning.
My goodness, what a last day. And we were unable to speak to you on Friday's Country Hour because the phone's been ringing a lot. Have you been getting some nice messages, people calling?
So many phone calls and gifts and that from just the loveliest people out, which I didn't expect in any shape or form, love. And I have just had so many calls from people, headmistresses from Kalkaringi School and Larjamanu and everywhere like that, love, have all been coming through or ringing. Thanks for your support and your help, and district nurses have all been. But you only treat people how you want to be treated yourself, Matt. That's
a good way to live life, absolutely. I've got a message here from the Daltons who say all the best to you, Pauline, a great publican.
Oh, he is lovely. He was the manager of the golf club. Just beautiful fella, beautiful family.
Hey, Pauline, can you take us back? How did you end up at Top Springs 12 years ago?
Well, to start off with, I come up here in 2002 from Adelaide on a holiday with some other friends. Faye Miller, the mayor of Katherine, as she is now, her and her husband Mike, when he was alive, had the Red Gum Caravan Park in Katherine, which is now called the Boab. And Faye and I had lots of fun together at school. She said somebody needs someone to cook for 3 weeks at Montagini Station. So my 3 weeks from 2002 finished up to 2007, and I come here in 2007 to take over the managing the hotel. So I have moved 16 kilometres in 18 years.
And what do you love about the Top Springs Hotel?
It's just, we got so many beautiful people coming through, all sorts of walks and lives. We've had lots of variety clubs through. We had Belinda Green, she was Miss World 1972. She came through raising funds for the Paralympics. We've had just some of the nicest people, just the young ringers that come in, just the passing trade, and you build up friendship and rapport with lots of people, and you treat people right, they treat you back right.
What's the biggest crowd, the biggest event you reckon you've seen there in your time?
Oh, we had a big show for Do It For Dolly.
Yep.
We raised lots of funds for that, about 10,000. We've had Variety Bash of 190 people come through from Balcombe Hills in New South Wales, and that was really good. But I reckon that would have been the biggest crowd we've had.
And so, Pauline, after all this time, where are you off to?
Well, my sons have been really sooky la-las and want me home back in South Australia. I said, it's usually the mum that tells the kids what to do, but they're telling me what to do. So I have my youngest son on his way from Darwin in a hire car at the moment, him and his fiancée, and coming here, picking me up, and we fly back to Adelaide at 6 o'clock on Tuesday morning.
How are you feeling about a life in Adelaide, in a capital city?
Oh, I'm getting a house built, and it's only half a kilometre from a beach, half a kilometre from my youngest son. It's not ready yet, so I'll just sharing myself around up to Sojourner with my sister and everywhere.
Now, I'm speaking to you on Friday afternoon, your last day. What's planned tonight there at the pub? Do you know, or is it being kept a secret on you?
I believe they've got a few people coming in tomorrow night. I've had phone calls galore. I bought a pile of meat the other day in case people come in for a barbecue. And I was just going to try and sneak out quietly. I don't think they're going to let me.
No, and they shouldn't let you sneak out quietly. You've just been such a major part of not just Top Springs, but the VRD. And I know here at the Country Hour, Pauline, we've always appreciated being able to give you a call and for you to tell us about what's going on in that part of the territory. It's always been lovely.
Oh, and it's been great, and I loved it. And Milton and Christina Jones are just the nicest people to work for.
Well, enjoy the last few days there at Top Springs, Pauline, and all the best from everyone who listens to the Country Hour.
All right, Matt. Look, thank you so much, and it's lovely knowing you, and it's been great. And thanks for your support over the years. So it's been absolutely wonderful talking to you.
Pauline from Top Springs, an absolute legend, and yeah, we wish her all the best in her next chapter there in South Australia. Hey, just quickly, if you were planning a trip into Western Australia, be mindful that the Great Northern Highway, Highway 1, has been closed in both directions from Willair to Fitzroy Crossing because of flooding, and as for the Gibb River Road, don't even think about it. The old Pentecost is up. The roads are wet, so Highway 1 closed between Willair and Fitzroy Crossing as we go to air this afternoon. Enjoy the rest of your Monday, and of course, keep it rural.